Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. This is the first case for Wednesday, January 11th. This would be Ashland v. O'Briens. For the appellant, Ashland, we have John Nooney, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the appellees, O'Brien, we have Thomas Barnes, an attorney also from Rapid City. Mr. Nooney, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Barnes. The appeal that is before this court today is a case of first impression in the state of South Dakota. The only issue that is before the court is the question of whether or not the interest damages, which were assessed by a Pennington County jury, should have legally been presented to the jury, or as a matter of law, as we argued in our motion for summary judgment, and we renewed it on the eve of trial, whether as a matter of law, the question of damages, IRS interest are in fact damages that are recoverable. A quick review of the facts I think are helpful in this case. My client, Mr. Bruce Ashland, is a certified public accountant who was providing tax and other financial services to the O'Briens. The O'Briens operated a small construction company out of Martin, South Dakota. Before 1995, Mr. O'Brien had always operated his business as a sole proprietor. And as a sole proprietor, that business recorded his income on a cash basis, i.e. the money he got in, he reported on his taxes, and he paid income tax on it. After the first quarter of 1995, Mr. O'Brien incorporated his business. And as a result of that incorporation, beginning in the second quarter of 1995, he was then obligated to report his income on an accrual basis. When Mr. Ashland prepared O'Brien's income tax return for 1995, Mr. Ashland inappropriately set forth on Schedule C, which would be the part of the return that would be applicable for sole proprietorship for the first quarter of 1995, he misidentified what the actual receipts Mr. O'Brien's business had realized in the first quarter. In fact, he significantly understated them. When in fact, Mr. O'Brien, for the first quarter of 1995, had cash receipts of something in excess of $900,000, Mr. Ashland identified them as something about $370,000. And when he did that, he misidentified Mr. O'Brien's net income for the first quarter of 1995 at something less than $1,000. But in fact, Mr. O'Brien, from the receipt of the $903,000 or actual receipts he had for the first quarter, actually had net income attributable to the first quarter of 1995 of something in excess of $560,000. The mistake that Mr. Ashland made created an additional tax liability to Mr. O'Brien of about $240,000. And this was a mistake that was made in the 1995 return that was prepared and filed in October of 1996. Approximately a year after that, when Mr. O'Brien was going through a divorce, this error came to everyone's attention, and Mr. O'Brien took it upon himself with a different accountant to go back and fix this problem. So the question that was going to be presented from a legal perspective and was argued by way of a motion for summary judgment before we tried the case was the legal principle that has not been addressed before by this court or any other court in the state of South Dakota. And that question is this: when a taxpayer has money that he does not rightfully have a right to have, and he underpaid his income taxes, and there's an interest assessed against that tax because the taxes were underpaid, does the taxpayer have a right to recover that interest from an accountant who made a mistake? There were several aspects of the decision that the jury ultimately entered. Most the aspect related to the Indian Employment Tax Credit and the aspect related to the damages for additional professional services is not on appeal in this case. The only question is the legal question of whether or not the issue of interest is actually a damage that can be recoverable. This court has previously dealt with accountant malpractice in most recently in the Lean versus McGladrey case. That case, although it addresses the principle of accounting malpractice, doesn't really address the issues which are before this court for the following reasons. In Lean, the question in that case was, arguably McGladrey had created a new tax liability that the Lean company should not have had. In this case, Judge Curran ruled before the case was ever tried by way of a motion for summary judgment. That wasn't the situation in this case because all parties, including Mr. O'Brien's own expert, acknowledged that the fact that there was a $239,000 additional tax liability, that wasn't a tax, that was not an obligation of Mr. Ashland. So in that regard, the Ashland case is distinguishable from the Lean case in that in Lean, the accountant's mistake created a tax liability that would not have otherwise existed. That is not the case in this situation. In this situation, the tax was due. Mr. O'Brien had the $500,000 of net income for that first quarter that he owed the tax on. And interesting, although it's not really particularly relevant to the legal issue that's before this case, before this court, at the time we tried this case, which started a year ago today, most of that tax liability still remained unpaid. And the argument that we presented to Judge Curran and then we also make to this court is the legal principle that it was set forth, in a Price Waterhouse decision based out of the state of Washington. And the legal principle that the Washington Supreme Court set forth is this premise right here, is that if a taxpayer has money, in that case, the accountant had made a mistake, the taxpayer, Linderstein, had $400,000 or $500,000 that they really weren't supposed to have, and ultimately it was found that they owed the money to the IRS. And the Washington Supreme Court in the Price Waterhouse decision said the taxpayer in that case had money that was not theirs. And when they came time to pay the IRS, in addition to the taxes that were due on that money, they also owed interest on the money. And the principle that the Washington Supreme Court set forth, which is generally viewed as the majority view across the country, is that taxpayers are not allowed to recover interest to the extent that they have an obligation to the IRS because it's really too speculative to determine whether or not they have been damaged. It goes without saying that in this situation, like the other cases we cite in our brief, the O'Briens had money, $239,000 that did not belong to them. And because they had that money and they ultimately owed interest to the IRS, the damages are not awardable and should not be awardable under our law because the taxpayer had the right to have that money. The taxpayer had the money until it was otherwise to be paid to the government. And interesting enough, like I noted before, in this situation, almost 10 years after the initial liability was incurred, the taxpayer still had never paid most of that money to the
IRS. But all that assumes that the taxpayer has the foresight to anticipate he's going to have to give the money to the IRS, therefore he better bank it and make some interest on it instead of going out and buying a tractor or something else that he needs. That's putting a pretty heavy burden on a taxpayer that was seeking professional advice, isn't it?
Well, it really isn't, because if you look at the teaching of the Washington Supreme Court and the Price Waterhouse decision, they really say something very interesting. They say it's really far too speculative for us to assume what a taxpayer may do with that money. For instance, Justice Gilbertson, if the taxpayer had the money and he buried it in his backyard, he could say, well, I didn't get any interest on that money and the IRS charged me 5 or 6%. Or vice versa, the taxpayer went out and bought Microsoft stock back in the boom days of the 90s. And what the Washington Supreme Court was telling us, and which has generally been adopted as the majority view, is it's far too speculative for us to assume what the taxpayer did or did not do with the money, because we should not be looking at that on a case-by-case basis.
Why not?
Well, because
why is that speculative? This person can show what he did with the money. He's got receipts, he's got a checking account, stubs and everything.
Well, interesting in this case is that this taxpayer acknowledged that at the time that he would have had the money, he most likely did not have the money to pay the IRS anyway. At the time, he was borrowing money from his community bank down in Martin on a line of credit at 10.5%. And under those set of facts, it was clearly established at the time of trial, but I don't think we get to the factual question because it's really a legal issue. But from a factual perspective in this case, this taxpayer, by his own admissions, would have had to borrow money from his local bank at a higher interest rate than the IRS ever charged him for the money, because that's really all the IRS was doing.
But there was testimony, too, though, that he could have borrowed money from his parents. If he had known he was going to have this liability, mean, was the jury instructed in a pattern instruction that they must not speculate on damages, that they must find that there is actual damage? Did they get that instruction?
Yes, Justice Kogan, that was one of the pattern instructions.
So if it isn't, I mean, if the jury is told you can't speculate, why is it so wrong to let the jury decide? In this case, both sides put in evidence about whether he was damaged or not, and the jury heard that evidence and in fact had a special interrogatory on it and said, answered the question, yes, in fact, in this case, he was damaged. Why not do this on a case-by-case basis rather than adopting a blanket rule where we say it's simply speculative as a matter of law?
Well, I think the distinction you have to make is this, is that if you look at the cases on both sides of the fence, those that are cited by Mr. Barnes and those that are cited by us, generally the courts have said this, it's a legal question of whether or not interest is awardable or not. I mean, that's a legal question. And then we can get to the facts, but the court in this case was unwilling, Judge Kern was unwilling to make the decision that as a matter of law, interest should not be a compensable item of damage. And what we're here arguing and suggesting to this court is that if you look at the majority view has clearly said that interest is not a compensable damage and should not be a compensable damage because in this situation, this taxpayer had money that was not his. And the fact that he had that money, that is not an element of damage because he had the benefit of that money. He had the benefit of having money that was not rightfully his. He had the receipts. He had $500,000 in net income that he paid no income tax on. So he had the benefit of that money. It's not appropriate for us to look at this on a case-by-case basis when, in fact, as a matter of law, the taxpayer had the money, and what the taxpayer does with it is really irrelevant because accepting the idea that we need to look at each one of these, if the taxpayer goes out and blows the money, he goes to Deadwood and loses it all, does that mean that that taxpayer has been damaged versus the person that goes down and makes a shrewd investment with their financial advisor and makes money on it? That's just an inappropriate thing for the jury to look at because it's too remote and it's not a proper element for the jury to consider for damages.
We trust the jury in other damage cases to sort out what's speculative and what isn't speculative. Why is it here that we can't trust the juries to look at this and say, this particular case it is too speculative and we can't award it, but in another case it isn't?
Well, I think the difference is that in this situation, this taxpayer had something. He had money that was not his.
But I thought that what triggered all this was he got his tax method to switch from cash to accrual. Is that correct?
But that really isn't correct for this reason, is that the first quarter of 1995, his incorporation was effective April 1 of 1995. So for the first quarter of that year, he was still a cash basis taxpayer. So what should have been reported, what Mr. Ashley made a mistake of, should have been reported was the actual receipts that he had received for that first quarter. Unfortunately, Mr. Ashley made a mistake. He understated it because he used the accrual method for the whole year, whereby understating his gross receipts for that first quarter by almost $600,000.
Doesn't that create another problem for us, though? Because as I understand it, the jury was also to decide whether or not your client improperly advised Mr. O'Brien about when to incorporate. And if he had incorporated at the beginning of the year as opposed to April, there would have been some the taxes would have still been due, but he could have paid them over a longer period of time.
There was some suggestions in Mr. Barnes' brief that that's in fact how the case was tried. But in fact what happened, Justice Gonenkamp, was this, is that their own expert, the plaintiff's own expert in this case, never offered any evidence. There was no evidence in front of the jury as to how this three-year amortization rule might have been effective if he'd incorporated on December 31st or effective April 1st. So there was never any testimony that the jury could have even seized on to make some determination if my client was negligent in that regard and there were some damages flowing from it, because that evidence was never presented to the jury. There was no expert testimony offered from anyone. The trouble, I think, is once...
Just a minute, though, the jury... I read where the jury was... plaintiff was asked if it was amortized and it was $80,000 a year, could he pay it? And he said yes. So there was testimony that if it was amortized over 3 years, he could pay it.
Well, there...
So there was some testimony from which a jury could have determined that it could have been paid.
Well, there was never any evidence in the record, though, Justice, to suggest that he had that ability. And I think the best evidence on that was this. He had a $239,000 tax liability attributable to this underreporting of his receipts. We tried the case a year ago today we started, which was more than 9 years after the return was filed. He still owed more than $182,000 of that tax liability, so he'd only paid $50,000 of that tax liability over the 9 years that happened since it had been incurred. So, I mean, there really wasn't any credible evidence that he had the ability to ever pay these taxes.
Well, he had $565,000 in cash.
And we don't know what he did with that, and that's the whole problem with this case, is he had the money, and he had subsequent years where he had net income in excess of $1 million, but he never has paid his income taxes. And that's the whole reason that we're here arguing that the legal principle that interest is not a compensable element of damage. It causes us to look at each one of those years and say, well, what decisions did he make other than to pay his taxes? He had sufficient cash, or so it appears on his income tax return. What he did with it...
Excuse me. Go ahead.
But what he did with it should not be our concern, because he had the money. He made a decision. He made a decision not to pay his taxes. And then if he made that decision, he had the benefit of money that belonged to the IRS. And that decision is a decision he made, and he should not be allowed to be compensated for damages for that.
One second, help me here understand. He's not, your client's not being required to pay interest after the effective day when your client was learned that he, there's a stopping point here where the decision to not pay taxes is no longer your client's problem, right?
There is, but if you look behind the facts that really happened here, the termination was made, the return was filed in October of 96. In November of 97, during the midst of Mr. O'Brien's divorce, the realization was made there was a mistake. By January of 98, the accountant that was retained by Mr. O'Brien said he had all the information to file the return, okay? He did not give the return or sign off on the return until June of 98. O'Brien did not actually file the return until October or November of 98.
Okay, but were those facts given to the jury so the jury could decide, you know, the effective date and how much damage he should get, so they could assess the fault of not doing it right away and handle that?
The jury had all that information, and the jury made the determination that they stopped the interest effective the day that the return was filed by Mr. O'Brien's new accountant. That'd be June of 1998. So in that regard, they had the information, but it still goes to the premise that we're here articulating to the court, and that is that the fact that we should not, and the law should not, look behind every taxpayer situation here to make a determination as to whether or not this taxpayer, you know, had a good investment going on, so he made a conscious decision, or he put the money in his backyard and didn't get any interest.
What about the tort concept? You take your victim as you find him.
Yeah, you do take the victim as you find it, but damages have to be the proximate cause of the person's negligence. And the Washington Supreme Court really said it best. They said it's really too speculative for us to look at each case to make a determination as to whether or not the taxpayer made the appropriate decision and whether or not he, in fact, did better than the IRS was going to charge him or did worse. And those damages are too remote, and that's what the genesis of all the decisions from New Jersey to Washington that have said, no, we don't want to look at that. That's not something that the court should be looking at.
In addition to the $50,000 in principal on the debt that the taxpayer paid, did he stay current on the interest over the years?
No, the interest is the number doesn't even, I can't even pull it out of the air right now, but the interest continues to accrue. I mean, there still continues to be interest on this obligation. The interest is, I believe, in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Would they let him pay the principal before they paid the interest?
I don't recall exactly now how the IRS's methodology worked on their sheet as to how it was applied, but it's my recollection that the interest and penalties remain outstanding at this time. In fact, I think the interest and penalties far now exceed whatever the tax liability ever was, because you pay the principal down, then you pay the interest, then you pay the penalty. That's my recollection as the savers of how they do that. But no, that interest continues to accrue.
How do you show this court that the accountant did not have some part in creating this liability in the sense of what's been mentioned before, in the sense of negligence as to advice as to when he should start the incorporation or convert or maybe never do it?
Well, I think we have to look at what happened before we tried the case in this situation. There were motions made, and both experts, including the plaintiff's experts, even said, The tax liability was the taxpayers. The tax liability was not a function of some negligence of my client. I mean, everyone, that's the one thing everyone agreed on in the trial, is that the tax liability, the $239,000, was not created by my accountant, by my client's actions. The court ruled as a matter of law that my client had no obligation for that tax liability because he did not create it. That tax liability clearly rested with the taxpayer.
Couldn't have been avoided by incorporating earlier or later, not incorporating?
No, you can't, because you cannot create a tax liability. He got the money. He got the $900,000 in the first quarter of 1995. So when he got that money, the best case that the plaintiff could have made is maybe we could have spread it out. But that's not what happened. In the end, everyone agreed to one thing. This taxpayer had $900,000 that he didn't pay taxes on. And that's what created the tax liability, nothing that Mr. Ashton did or did not do.
So your support for the what you claim to be the majority rule, the Washington Supreme Court rule, is that where the accountant did not create the tax liability, then he has no obligation for the interest that's due on it.
May I answer that, Justice?
Oh, yeah, yes.
That's exactly right, Justice Sabers. If you don't create the tax liability, you do not have an obligation to pay the interest. And that's how the lien case is somewhat different. In that case, the accountant created the tax liability, hence he had to pay the interest. Here, the accountant did not create the tax liability.
And their reasoning is that it's just, they're not going to speculate. They don't want to go through they don't want to jump through the hoops speculating as to whether or not he had the money or didn't have the money or was making more elsewhere on it.
Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nooney. Mr. Barnes, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, Mr. Nooney. Good morning. My name is Tom Barnes, as everyone up there knows, and I represent the appellee in this matter. I might refer to him as O'Brien or Doug O'Brien or O'Brien Construction, but we all know whom I'm up here to represent. At the very outset, I want to advise the court that I have a hearing loss, and if I sometime go what or ask you to repeat it, it's not because I'm asleep or somewhere else. I kind of relate that to the fact that I lost this in Vietnam in the 101st Airborne in an artillery unit. Mr. Nooney will probably argue that I lost it because of the amount of years I've been on Earth. And why do I bring that up? Because that creates a factual issue for the jury. That's a bottom line of my argument in front of this body today. As a factual issue was created concerning the interest, the jury decided it, and it should not be set aside because it hasn't even been argued that was there any kind of insufficiency of evidence or anything else to set aside that verdict.
So you would concede in some cases that would be different than your client's, you could not recover interest because you haven't been damaged under the theory that the other side is espousing. You're saying it's a factual call.
Exactly. And how do I get to that? Mr. Nooney advised the court that there is no precedent in this state that there's no spotted cow cases. Yet there does exist a number of spotted cow cases, including the lien case, which says in a professional malpractice case, whether it's a lawyer, a doctor, or an accountant, there's certain things, and the same rules apply to all of those. And one of these rules, and probably the most important one in this particular case, is set forth in many South Dakota cases, as set out in my brief, is that in a professional malpractice case, you have to get people from that profession in there to testify to a duty, a breach of duty, proximate cause, and damages. Now, in this case, we didn't have to do that because Mr. Ashmore testified or agreed that he'd done malpractice. And not only for 1 year, 2 years, 1994 and 1995. So the only real question, as Mr. Nooney said, is whether or not interest is in fact a damage which should be allowable in these kind of cases as to be determined by the jury.
Do you agree, sorry to interrupt you, but do you agree with your opponent that both of the professionals involved in this were of the opinion that the accountant had no responsibility as far as creating the tax liability?
Certainly. You know, if you make so much money, depending upon your deductions and so forth, you have to pay so much in taxes.
So there was no negligence on the accountant's part in reference to the timing of when they were incorporating?
Well, as to the timing when they were incorporated, yes. And that gets into something that I agree, disagree with Mr. Nooney, and that is what the three-year rule is and the effect that played in this particular matter. The three-year rule, at least as I understand it, and I'm not an accountant, but as everyone seemed to agree, says that when you change over from one accounting method to the other, the IRS realizes that in many instances there's a tremendous tax burden placed upon the taxpayer, as was in this case. The IRS then says that if you satisfy all the requirements for this rule, we're going to let you spread that tax liability over 3 years rather than have to pay it in the year it comes due. And if you can pay it over 3 years, there will be no interest or no penalty for those 3 years. Now, why is that important in this particular case is because, as Mr. Ashland even testified, he says, hey, O'Brien lost the opportunities for the three-year rule because of my error. That was not available for him. And it wasn't. And I also disagree strongly with Mr. Nooney's statement to you that we could not have paid this in the year that it would have become due. O'Brien said he might have been able to, and you have to remember, we're not talking $239,000. We're talking $80,000 or less if we got the benefit of the three-year rule, which all the accountants said we would have.
Well, I guess I'm confused now, because Mr. Nooney said that really wasn't an issue that was testified about by the experts. I may be misquoting it, but something to the effect that the three-year rule really didn't play a part in this because there was no testimony, the expert testimony, that showed that there was a loss because of that.
Well, because Mr. Nooney called it speculation, but it's awful hard to go back 10 years or 5 years or 4 years and say we could have done this, we could have done that, but you have to look at Mr. Gardner's testimony, first of all, the expert retained by Mr. O'Brien. He said there probably was some tax planning that could have occurred. We could have sold something, bought something, whatever, to reduce the amount of taxes. He said it might have even put him in a lower bracket. So there was testimony. And there's a ton of testimony from Mr. O'Brien that said, hey, I could have maybe sold something. I might have had some money in my accounts at the end of that year.
Was there testimony that the $80,000 amortization would have put him in a lower bracket?
Pardon me, Steve?
Was there testimony that the $80,000 amortization rule would have put him in a lower tax bracket? Because that would affect liability.
What Mr. O'Brien said, as best I will recall, is that he could have borrowed it. No one knows at what interest rate, because he could have borrowed it from his family. Number two, that there might have been some money in the account. We have to remember we're talking $80,000. And so even if he would have had to borrow 40 of it, because he had 40 in there, we're still talking he would have lost some interest and suffered some damages. And I want to get back to another point at this deal, and Mr. Ashton's testimony himself, which I think is very key. Ashton testified that there were instances or circumstances when an accountant in a malpractice case would be responsible for some interest. And then he said this isn't one of them and gave his reasoning for that. Now, why is that the key? Because Ashton's own testimony, which he's bound by, establishes that there is situations that do exist when interest would be recoverable by a taxpayer because of malpractice. He said this isn't one of them. Mr. Gardner says it was. So what do we have here but a factual issue created by the testimony of Mr. Ashton himself that was submitted to a jury and the jury ruled? Ashton would have us believe that it would never be a situation, the way they argue this case, wherein anyone would ever have to pay for taxes because he has the money. But to me, the bottom line of this is he did have the money. If he had the money and known about the taxes, he could have paid them. That makes sense, doesn't it? He paid taxes every other year. Also, they want to say almost that we gave him a benefit because the interest rate was lower than he could have borrowed the money yet, so we really got a break in this deal. Well, to that I kind of have to say, that just doesn't make sense to me, folks. The real gravamen of this is he didn't have the chance. he'd lost the opportunity to make these decisions, which obviously, if he had to pay $80,000, and he did owe, he owes a total of $239,000 on this money. I can't argue with that. But he didn't have the chance to try to reduce that because of the actions of Mr. Ashland.
At what point, if the taxes remained unpaid, does the interest obligation, under your theory, switch from the accountant to your client?
What's that again, Your Honor?
At what point, if the taxes remain unpaid, does the interest obligation switch from the accountant to your client?
Well,
so apparently they're still unpaid, or part of them are, from what
that's right. And I think during the trial, first of all, to answer that question at the start indirectly, Mr. O'Brien testified why it hasn't been unpaid. They went through this deal with the IRS where some people, at least is how he testified, it wasn't contested, were completely upfront with him, and they went through two or three offers of compromise and tried to resolve the situation, and it wasn't. But we are satisfied with the date that they cut it off for purposes of this appeal. We weren't at the time of trial, obviously. We argued that it should be extended further, but that isn't an issue here. The only issue as to the timing is the date has started, and since that was brought up, I want to point out that there was no evidence whatsoever that it should have started at a date other than the date the taxes were originally due of April 15, 1996. How the jury came up with their conclusion, I don't know, but there's no evidence to that effect. And again, South Dakota law is fairly clear that a jury's verdict, it's very difficult to set that aside. But if it's rendered in a situation where there's no common sense, no evidence, or no law to back it up, then it should be overturned. And I present to this court that that is the situation in this case.
You know, the Washington Supreme Court's rule has the virtue of simplicity, if nothing else. What's wrong with that rule that simply says that in these cases, rather than trying to go have juries try to figure out all these complicated tax issues, we simply say, let's just have a rule that says that it's too complicated, and when, as a matter of law, you can't collect it?
Well, if I understand your question, I don't think that reasoning applies to this case, Your Honor, or Justice, because every accountant in this case testified as to when things should start, and there's ample evidence as to where the jury felt at the end. It was presented to the jury. It wasn't a complicated situation. If you read the special interrogatories, it says, do you feel there was damages? Do you feel this was a damages? When do it start and when do it end? That was basically, I think there were about half a dozen special interrogatories submitted to the jury in this case. And that's my whole point. A jury issue was created. I think South Dakota law in a malpractice, professional malpractice case says that in fact, an expert does have to testify from that profession as to elements of damage. It was done in this case by both Mr. Ashland and by Mr. Gardner, and to some extent even by Mr. Kramer. It was presented to the jury under proper instructions, and the jury awarded its verdict, and it should be sustained, although the time as to when the interest started accruing should be changed, because there's no evidence that it started on the date. I think they started in October.
But they used the date that he actually filed. The jury's date, if I recall, coincided with the extensions that he'd actually asked for at the time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I just can't understand you. I apologize.
All right, I'll look it up in the record.
Okay. It's a terrible thing having a loss of hearing, but there are other problems that are greater, I guess. And
well, my wife tells me that I've got that problem too, but I think it's only on specific events. I'm a little bit confused. I understand that you indicated that the professionals agreed that there was no negligence on the part of the accountant that created the tax liability in the first place. And yet, you didn't seem to answer Justice Konenkamp's question as to when the accountant has not created the tax liability, that it was there, then then what's wrong with the Washington rule where they say it's too speculative?
Well, I think the Washington rule relies on a number of things to make it speculative. Number one is that they say we have the money, we receive some benefit from it. That was never shown in this case that we received any benefit. I think the Washington rule has no applicability or shouldn't be applied herein because of the fact that not only did they show no benefit, but we weren't given the choice. I mean, to me, and that didn't happen in the Washington cases or any of the cases cited by Mr. Nooney, where we had the chance to do something to lessen that liability. We could have paid it. We could have done some tax planning. We could have done this. We could have done that. All these cases seem to be based on the fact that we have some money, there's some benefit to us by not paying it. Because ultimately we have to pay it anyway. Everybody knows that. So the only benefit would be something that is derived during the time that we have that money, which incidentally, in these cases all seem to say, is the burden of proof shifts to the defendant to show that because it's a mitigation issue. That's why I don't think the Washington case is applicable, Justice. Any other questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early. Thank you. Mr. Nooney, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Nooney, before I lose my chance to get in here, I want you to clarify for me the record on whether there would have been a total waiver of taxes by the IRS had the three-year apportionment rule been used.
No, it wouldn't have changed the taxes at all. I mean, all the...
No, the interest, I'm sorry, interest, was interest waived during the three-year amortization rule?
As the testimony was, Justice Inter, if an incorporation had occurred at a date other than when it occurred, would have had to occur back before the beginning of the year. There was an argument, although there was some dispute about it at the time of trial, as to what that would have actually done to the tax liability. And I think, and I can't cite you exactly the page of the record, I know it's in our brief though, I asked Jim Gardner, who was the plaintiff's expert in this case, if he had ever calculated what effect that three-year rule would have had on the tax liability or the resulting interest, and I believe his testimony, I know it to be true. I don't know, I've never done that calculation, Mr. Nooney. I don't know how that would have changed the tax liability or how it would have ever changed the interest. So there really wasn't any evidence in the record to suggest that the tax liability or the interest would have been changed because there were no calculations that had been done by the plaintiff's expert in this case as it concerns that.
But there should be an IRS rule or statute that says interest is payable during the 3 years or it's not.
Well, here's the deal. It depends upon certain situations. It depends upon the size of the business. It depends upon the size of the receivables of the business. It depends on a bunch of different factors. And as I think we all can probably appreciate, even though most of us aren't tax lawyers, the IRS code is anything but clear, and that's the reason why it's this big and not, you know, as small as a small phone book might be. So there was no real clarity as to whether or not that three-year rule would have been applicable. But I think the important thing, Justice Inter, is this, is that in this case, the three-year rule was, without a doubt, wasn't applicable because this taxpayer incorporated his business effective April 1 of 1995. And because of that, they could never have availed themselves of the opportunity for that three-year rule, even to the extent that it might have been applicable.
Why not?
Because under the IRS code, it wasn't available to them anymore. Because you would have had to incorporate it in a different time frame, and you would have had to make certain that you fit into all the different the rules and the safe harbor provisions of that three-year rule. That three-year amortization rule had no application to this, and I think both experts testified to that, given an incorporation date when this incorporation occurred.
If it incorporated at the end of the prior year, would the rule have been applicable?
It may have been. There wasn't a clear decision, Justice Sabers, about that, whether or not that rule would have been, or that three-year amortization would have been applicable in this case or not.
And wasn't there an allegation of negligence for failure to advise to incorporate at a different time other than after the first quarter?
There were allegations about that, But in the end, it's without dispute, and it's not an appeal in this case, the fact that Judge Kern made a decision before we tried the case that the tax liability was clearly the taxpayer's responsibility. The taxpayer had all of the obligation for the taxes that were due as a result of the taxpayer receiving $900,000 in receipts in the first quarter of 1995. So that wasn't in dispute, Judge Estes. So I don't think that really wasn't a question the jury had to decide. The only question the jury had to decide was that, the only one that's on appeal anyway, is the question of whether or not interest should be awarded and for what time period. The other decisions they made were not appealing. We acknowledge that the additional costs and those things are our responsibility.
So, you know, obviously this case will have far-reaching consequences. In a future malpractice case, your theory would not apply to additional tax. The taxpayer would have to pay or a penalty.
That's absolutely correct. And I think, and if I could go to Mr. Barnes's brief and read just one passage out of it, I think it tells us why this court needs to adopt the principle that we have advocated in this case. He cites the Holston versus Melman Food Industries case, and the quote is this: the object of compensatory damages is to make the injured party whole. And we're not here to modify that. All we're telling this court, and we're advocating for the adoption in by the state of South Dakota, is the principle the taxpayer to be made whole doesn't have to be paid for interest that the taxpayer had the right to have the money that wasn't, that he should not have had. And if we go to, and I left it back to my desk, but if you go to the Washington Supreme Court's decision, thank you.
You bet.
I apologize for that. If we go to the Washington Supreme Court decision, and it's very insightful, when they cite to the fact that the majority of jurisdictions have held that interest is not a recoverable item. And they say the following: when you look at a standard negligence, and we all know what those standards are, the different 5 points we have to look at, they say the two elements that cannot be met when you look at a case involving IRS interest is the legal causation and the damages. And they come to the conclusion that legal causation as relates to interest payable to the IRS is not an element of damage because it's just too speculative. The premise that you have to accept to adopt the argument we have here is we cannot, and the court should not, be looking at each business judgment that a taxpayer makes as to what they're going to do with the money. It's without dispute that the taxpayer in this case had the money. What he or she decided to do with the money should not be a consideration for us, and the whole premise that we're here advocating for is that when the taxpayer has the money on a tax that he owes, the taxpayer should not be allowed to be compensated for damages for that because the taxpayer gets to make a decision. In this case, it's without dispute. The taxpayer had the cash.
Your own expert, though, as I recall in a hypothetical, admitted there was a scenario where the accountant would be responsible for interest damages.
I think what you're referring to, Justice Zinter, is there was some dialogue that we originally was cited by Mr. Barnes in his appellee brief that we also went back to in our appellant reply brief. And I think if you read the entire text of what we have placed in our appellant's reply brief, the accountant said no. I mean, the accountant said interest is not a recoverable element of damage. And Mr. Barnes tries to advocate that a premise that the accountant can create a duty, create a legal obligation when one doesn't exist. He was trying to point to some facts, but I mean, a person that testifies can be bound to certain facts, but he cannot create a duty if legally there's not a duty. And that's what our response to Mr. Barnes was, is Mr. Ashland, by his testimony, cannot create a duty. Duties are established by courts. And the question we had and we advocated to Judge Kern and now we're advocating to you is that a legal duty does not exist because it's too speculative for this court or any court to have a set of facts have to be developed to say, well, what did taxpayer John Doe do with the money? Well, he put it in his backyard. Well, then he's been damaged. Well, no, John Doe decided to go invest the money in Microsoft stock and made a bunch of money. Well, he did better than the IRS interest. That should not be a concern of ours because it causes us to get too far removed from the legal question, the legal causation issue. And that's the reason why the Washington Supreme Court, which the majority of jurisdictions across this nation have adopted, have been, IRS interest is not a recoverable element of damage, and that's what we're advocating to this court. The taxpayer had the money, the taxpayer did not pay the taxpayer was not damaged, and he should not be allowed to recover interest as a compensable damage in South Dakota law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nooney. The court will be in recess until 10 o'clock.